This evening we continue our time in 1 Timothy, and so if you would turn back to 1 Timothy chapter 3. I suppose there is a way of approaching this text that is really isolating. I suppose one of the ways you could isolate yourself from these verses is by forgetting that these lines have a context. And the temptation is to see this as its own isolated kind of portion of text. It has nothing to do with what's gone before. And another way I suppose you could isolate this text is, well, to say that this text doesn't pertain to me, so long as I'm not an elder or a deacon. I suppose it won't surprise you for me to tell you this evening, I'm going to encourage you not to isolate the text in either way. What we have here is, of course, the Word of God. The Word of God in a context, but also the Word of God that is supposed to be applied to each individual within the church. And so that's how we'll approach the text with God's help this evening. I want you to notice that there is a real connection with what he says in chapter 3 here to what's gone before. You remember, as the apostle is dealing with the Ephesian heresy, he comes to that particular issue of roles in the church. That's what we considered last midweek. And in that, you remember, what the apostle sets forward is the idea that in the public assembly of God's people, there is to be a real display of the reclaiming work of Christ. You remember, the apostle explains that there are specific roles in the church for men and for women, but the purpose of those roles is to reflect a created order. And then, friend, why is it then that after a world distorted by the fall, after a society so sold under sin that even these things are forgotten, why is it that the church demonstrates these distinctions that are rooted in creation, that are rooted in God? Well, friend, the answer is the work of Christ. You see, what the second Adam repairs is what the first Adam destroyed. And so what the apostle sets forward for us is nothing less than this idea that in the church of Christ, you are to see the first fruits of a new creation. Through the second Adam, that which was undone has been remade. Now, as you come to chapter 3, you can see that there's a very clear picture as to why we're moving now to discussion about church officers. What we see here is a church functioning normally. Remember, the idea here is that normalcy is not common. Normalcy is what ought to be. And as the apostle approaches the church at Ephesus, he's keen to show them very clearly, this is what those who are over you are supposed to look like. This is their calling, in a sense. It perfectly fits with what he said in chapter 2. I want you to notice, though, that as we look at this text, even though it's supposed to be held within its greater context, this is its own section of text. In verse 1, he says, this is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. And then jump down to verse 13. For they that have used the office of a deacon well, purchase to themselves a good degree, or a good position, or a good property, and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. Now, I point that out to you this evening because in ancient literature, just across the board, what you have here is a way of designating a particular text or isolating a particular text and saying this is one particular unit. Before we got our New Testament divisions from Stephen Foster in the 13th century, what ancient writers would do is they would often begin with a theme and close with that same theme to show you that this is precisely one unit of text. This is, if you will, its own chapter. And the apostle says that what we have here then is both a good office, a good work, verse 1, and a good possession, verse 13. He opens and he closes with this idea that in the church and in the offices of the church, there is something good to be obtained, something good to be pursued. And so I suppose it's customary to take this text and divide it into two, verses 1 to 7, being particularly the work of the elder, verses 8 to 13 being the work of the deacon. And of course, in any context, that may be useful and edifying. But this evening, I want us to hold both of those themes together. to treat this as one unified text. And I want to begin by, first of all, looking at this idea of the bishop. Now, the word bishop there, of course, is the word for overseer. And it's synonymous to what the apostle will use later to describe those who are leaders in the church as presbyters, chapter 5. The idea here is, of course, not the diocesan episcopacy of the Anglican tradition. We're thinking here about genuine pastoral ministry. In fact, a teaching pastoral ministry, as you see at the end of verse 2. What you have here, then, are presbyters, men who are pastors, gospel ministers. And he says, as you'll notice here, that these are the thing that is in and of itself desired. It's a good thing. Notice that. It is a good thing if a man desires this work. Now, I want you to notice that it is teaching that we have in view here. We'll only pause there just for a moment. But here you have the apostle saying there are those who are called elders, overseers, pastors, who are particularly supposed to be gifted in teaching. Now, if you come down to verse 7 then, he gives us the next office, and that's that of the deacon. The deacon here being, the word could easily be translated servant or helper, as it is in other texts. And the sense is that these are those who you find mentioned first of all, of course, in Acts chapter 6. You remember the context. The apostles are preaching, but they're also giving themselves particularly to table work. And then whenever a row is started between those who are widows of the Greeks and those of the Jews, it's necessary for the diaconate to be instituted. They do this, the apostles, that is, by divine ordination. And as we see throughout this text, it's of continued permanence in the church. But the sense here is you have two offices. Now, I said before that it's dangerous, I believe, for us to isolate this text from what's gone before. This text, by God's ordination, through God's inspiring work, has given us this text from a context. The apostle is writing, under inspiration of God's Spirit, to an Ephesian problem. Now, what some have done is they've said, well, there are only then two offices in the church. The reality is the New Testament speaks really of 3.5 or 4 offices. You remember, of course, in Ephesians chapter 4, there are those who are given to preach, to teach. There are those who are given to rule, and then there's, of course, those who are given to minister, the diaconate. The question then is, why is it that the apostle isolates particularly the preacher and then the deacon? I think the answer to that comes from the Ephesian problem. The church in Ephesus was facing, as you remember, false teachers. Men who had risen up with a false gospel, a distorted law, and were preaching as wolves, seeking to deceive the flock. Here the apostle shows us this is the character of those who are genuine preachers. You see, he's making a very real contrast between those who he already has addressed in chapter 1, the wolves that had come into Ephesus. But then why then the diaconate? As you come to chapter 5, as we'll see, God willing, in a few weeks' time, another problem in the church at Ephesus was the mismanagement of the church's funds, particularly when it came to mercy ministry and mercy needs. And what the apostle is doing now is he is preempting any possibility of thinking that that kind of behavior is actually in accord with the biblical diaconate. In other words, he's coming to a congregation and he's saying, here you have seen two offices that have been radically distorted. Here, friend, here is the biblical norm. That's what he sets before us. Though, of course, there's application to the ruling elder, and of course, as well, there's application to the doctor as well in the church. And we'll get to that, God willing, toward the end of our time this evening. But I want us to see at the very beginning here that what we have in this text is a clear affirmation that the offices that are in the church are inherently good. The work of the overseer is inherently good. The work of the deacon is an inherently good work. And we also need to see here that while the apostle is setting for us this contrast between those wolves that were in Ephesus and those men who ought to fill those offices, well, friend, the contrast is not so much the function of their office, not so much the qualifications of their office in an official capacity, But friend, it's much more their moral qualifications. We have to go to other New Testament texts to really flesh out the whole work of the pastor. We have to go to other New Testament texts to give us a clearer view of the diaconate. What the apostle does here is he says this is the character or the spiritual integrity that a man is to have if he possesses either of these offices. These are moral qualifications that we have to do with. Sometimes these texts are treated as though this is the sum and summary of these offices. But as we'll see, God willing, in just a few minutes, what we have here is really the root of a man's effectiveness in either offices, his godliness. And then finally, I want you to see here that as the apostle is descending into these discussions about government of the church, he has not lost sight of the church that he had before. You remember the apostle maintains a Christ-centered view of God's people. This is not an addendum. This is not an appendix to his epistle. This is not, as it were, isolated from the gospel that he's previously explicated. These things are integrally tied together. And with God's help, we'll see that this evening. Our theme then is that the lives of gospel ministers and deacons must show the holiness of their callings. The lives of gospel ministers and deacons must show the holiness of their callings. And we'll consider this in just two headings. First, the goodness of the offices themselves, and then we'll see also the exhibition of that goodness, particularly in the qualifications that we have here. And so first, the goodness of the offices. You'll again remember, the apostle says here that these are good things, particularly good intrinsically. These are not offices that are borrowed goodness from those who hold them. But those who hold the diaconate, those who are in gospel ministry, are in an office that is inherently good. And the question is why? Well, from that, friend, we need only to look at the origin. Where do these offices come from? They don't originate with men. Some would teach a view of church government where man is really the final arbiter when it comes to how the church ought to be run. Not so the biblical writers. You see, friend, as you go to Ephesians 4, the apostles root the government of the church in the ascended Christ. You see, as Christ is ascended, as king over Zion, he ordains how his kingdom will be governed on earth. There are some who have this view of that Christ has been ascended and as it were, he is dormant in the interim. Friend, that could not be further from the truth. And one of the first things that the apostle would say to that is you see a faithful ministry. Then friend, there's a Christ who yet reigns in Zion. Because Christ is the one who has both appointed the office and called the man. It originates from Christ as Zion's king. But friend, it also originates from Christ as the great shepherd. As we'll see in just a minute or two, the purpose of these offices is to ameliorate the condition of his people. Friend, these things are instituted not that men might exercise dominion over the people of God, not that they might have lordship over God's heritage, but that the people of God might be edified through Christ using these offices as his instruments. You see, friend, there's a problem in evangelicalism today that I wonder it might even creep into our circles as well. Where we begin to think that church government is, well, it's just a necessary but insignificant part of Christian experience. But friend, the apostolic view of these things is that these things bear the fingerprints of an ascended Christ. These things come to the church of Christ as an expression of his continued love and care for them. And we mustn't lose that focus this evening. But friend, we also see here that not only is this good in terms of its origin, coming from Christ, it's good in terms of the work. You remember, as the apostles refer to their own labor at the institution of the diaconate, they have been called, and they desire to return to that one work of giving themselves particularly to the word and to prayer. The work of the gospel ministry shadows that, as you find out toward the end of this epistle. There are those who are ordained who are called specifically to labor in word and in doctrine. Friend, think about that. Christ has called men who are sinful dust, dust, rebellious dust, to labor in his word, to minister nothing less than the unsearchable riches of Christ. As Charles Spurgeon put it, it's a demotion then to become a king if you're first called to be a pastor. The dignity of the work itself says that this is a good work. It is a very good work. But friend, the diaconate's no different. The diaconate also is called by the apostle here as a good possession, a good thing to have. And why is that? Well, friend, you remember that the calling of the deacons in Acts 6 was particularly for mercy ministry. But why? Why was it so necessary that the widows, both of the Hebrews and of the Greeks, why was it necessary that the church tend to their outward care? Some would think that that's beneath the dignity of the church. Oh, but friend, you remember, the church is to exhibit a lively faith, a faith that is accompanied with works. Works that demonstrate the love, the benevolence of God in all things. And so, friend, what occurs? Well, once the diaconate is instituted in Acts 6, the gospel goes out, as the apostle tells us, with great power. Why? You see, the calling of the deacon is to demonstrate practically the reality of the gospel. That is his calling. As he extends mercy ministry to the world and in the church, he does so not as his own man. He does so, as it were, in the place of Christ. This is Christ's office to extend the cold cup of water. This is Christ's office to demonstrate his continued care for his own and his continued power in making men who were once haters of God, once at enmity with other men, made servants and even lovers of men. But this work is not just good in its origin and in its own work, but it's also good in its end. Ephesians 4 tells us that the work of the pastor is that all men might be built up in the unity of the faith until the coming of Christ. The people of God are to be safeguarded, as it were, almost watched over as if to be cared for as a deposit, almost to be cared for as an inheritance. And I say almost, but really the scriptures say that quite literally. These are those who are under shepherds for the flock of God. The purpose is nothing less than the edification of Christ's blood-bought people. And then what, friend, is the purpose of the diaconate? Why is that a good work in its end? As you remember, in Acts 6, through the diaconate, God's use of it, the world saw that there was a genuine work of the gospel. And therein, the power of the gospel was manifest to a world who otherwise rejected it. Friend, that is also part of the diaconate. And we'll see that even for the deacon himself. His calling is that through his ministry, there might be boldness in the faith. But that brings us then particularly to the exhibition of these good offices in the lives of those who are our office holders. And we'll begin here first with the pastoral office. He says here in verse 2 that a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. That word blameless, it doesn't mean that he's perfect in a sinless sense. In fact, as we get later into the epistle, the apostle will deal with the fact that not all of those who are ordained, in fact, none of those who are ordained, are sinless. He deals with how to treat that particular problem in the church later. But the blamelessness that's in view here is the idea that the man does not live in a scandalous way. In other words, the man is not notoriously living contrary to the gospel that he preaches. Why is that significant to the Ephesian church? Well, friend, as we'll find, that's precisely what the false teachers were doing in Ephesus at the time. They would preach and also live scandalously. But part of that, and I read these two together for a reason, part of that is that they are to be monogamous. The husband of one wife. Whereas it is in the original, a one-man woman, a one-woman man, rather. And the calling here, simply enough, is that he is, of course, to have only one wife in a society that was habitually polygamous. It was polygamous not only from the Gentile perspective, but at that time, particularly in the first century, we're told that it was actually becoming quite a growing practice among the Jews, as they were trying to reenact, for instance, the likes of Abraham and Jacob and others. The apostle says, these men who are called to this office are to be monogamous. But we can take that a step further, can't we? Perhaps polygamy is not our great problem, but it is a problem that men today are hardly content in their marriages, hardly content with their wives. And here the apostle clearly says that those who are called to this office must be content, must protect that marital fidelity. It must be a precious, cherished thing to them. Friend, there's a simple reason for that, though, isn't there? The man who preaches the gospel of Jesus Christ, but in his home doesn't demonstrate the love of Christ to the church, what does that gospel really sound like then? To those who hear him but know that he doesn't care so much about his own marriage, it's a dangerous thing, friend. When those who say that Christ loves his church so much as to die for her will not exemplify that gospel in his own home. It's a dangerous thing. It's purely hypocrisy. And here the apostle says, this ought not to be. But then he comes here to vigilance or watchfulness. And with that, he says, they are to be sober, of good behavior. And the sense here is that vigilance is an idea that conveys the work of that man who is to be on the wall of the city, the watchman. He was to be a watchman. Why? Because those who are called to do this work, they're called to watch the congregation. They're called to oversee it. They're called to be careful in it. But they're also to be watchful over themselves, which I think is perhaps more clearly the meaning in this text. You see, the man who is called to this labor, he must know himself. He must know the risings of sin within, and he also must know something of the practical work of grace if he's going to be effective at all. If he's going to be actually a physician of souls, he needs to be a man who knows by experience these things, both the realities of sin and grace. And so he must be watchful. He must be. And that involves, of course, that sobriety, that gravity. The man who's called to this work, friend, he cannot be flippant. And if he really is watchful, he knows that the dangers are real and also that the grace and the glory of it is also real. And that will make him a sober man, not a flippant one. But it won't make him dour either. And you see, that also is a form of flippancy. The man that we have in view here is a man who has been sobered by his experience, by his knowledge of the gospel. And he carries that with him, not just behind the pulpit, but he carries that with him in his conduct without. This is the life of a man called to this work. He is to be sobered, a man who has a view to eternity at every point. He's to be hospitable, given to hospitality and apt to teach. What's striking to me is, as we look at this word, the word hospitality here actually doesn't refer to that kind of service that you would do to a friend. The work of hospitality here is actually more referring to bringing strangers into one's home and caring for them. That's perhaps a striking thing. I think from the 19th century on, we in the Reformed Church have not done well at seeing this particular part of the calling. But what the apostle says very plainly is the gospel minister is called to actually invite sinners into his own home and to care for them. The sense of hospitality there is that he's also meeting their basic, most necessary needs. James Fraser of Bray captured this, I think, very beautifully. He said, when I was called to the gospel ministry, I was called to do good to men, to all men in body and in soul. And you see, friend, that's part of the calling. Our forebears understood that when a man was called by a particular church, yes, he was their governor. He was, by Christ's appointment, on the session as a ruler in the congregation for Christ. But he was also called to do good for all of those that he came in contact with. That was part of his calling. It was not just that he ministered only to those within, but also to all those without. And here the apostle preaches that very plainly. This is a man who is called to be truly a minister to souls, to every soul that he can come in contact with. And with that, there's this sense that he's apt to teach. Now, it's almost parenthetical in this text, but I want you to see that it's really much, very much connected with it, hospitality. It was either Lord Burley or Lord Cecil who, at the end of his time, he said, at the end of the day, he threw off his treasury robe and said, "Lie there, Lord Treasurer." And he crawled into bed and go to sleep. The gospel minister is called not to do that. He's to preach in season and out of season. In his home, even, he's to be a teacher. He's to do good to souls at all times. He never, as it were, is able to throw off the robe, so to speak, of his calling. But with that is joined these next statements. He's a man who's not given to wine, no striker, not greedy, of filthy gain or lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous. In other words, he is a man that through and through, well, he's a man who demonstrates the love of Christ and demonstrates that he is free from the constraints of the world. Which then brings the apostle to that question of the minister's home. Verse 4, "One that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity." And then that parenthetical statement, that this is absolutely necessary to his calling. You see, as the apostle moves forward, he demonstrates that the man is to demonstrate a continued and faithful leadership from his home. The man's first calling is to demonstrate then that he is a faithful husband and a faithful father. And only if he is that, then he may be a faithful minister. That's the order of it. And friend, that shouldn't surprise us. The purpose, of course, of the gospel ministry is to exhibit the power of God's grace. And that grace makes men faithful in every station to which they are called. The man is not to be a novice. That's not to be somebody newly converted in the faith. And there are these warnings that he is not to do so, not to call him to this office, lest he fall into the condemnation of the devil. And then, as you come to verse 7, he is to be a man of good report without. He is to be a man esteemed holy by those outside. It doesn't mean he needs to be well-liked by the world. In fact, if he is a holy man, he won't be well-liked by the world. But the world ought to know that he is holy. He's a godly man. And the warning then is that if he's not, he will fall into the reproach and snare of the devil. We'll come back to those here in just a minute. But what we find here then is the apostle laying out for us the characters that fit the man who is called to the work of the pastorate. But as you move then to the diaconate in verse 8, you'll notice that the man here, he's also called to be a grave man, which is a synonym to that word that we found previously, sober. He's to be a man who is subdued. He's a man who is not dour, but he has eternity set in front of him, and he ministers out of that. Even his work that may seem so temporal, so mundane, is to be touched with this sense that the realities of the gospel are always before him and that he ministers from that. And from there you see that this man, he's to be sober, which then induces him to be a man not given to the following vices. He's not a man who's double-tongued. That word there is dialogos, two words. It means both that he's not insincere. He's a sincere man, in other words. But he's also not a man who's going to repeat things. He's not a gossiper. Now, why is that so significant? As we find in chapter 5, that's precisely what you find among one of the problems in the church at Ephesus. There were those who were mismanaging the work of the diaconate, but also those who were gossipers. Men who were double-tongued. And the work of the diaconate requires greater greater confidence and greater care with these kinds of things. And then it says here that he's not to be given to much wine, not greedy of filthy lucre. Things already spoken of with regard to the minister. Why, friend? The deacon is Christ's minister. He's not just a generous man. He's not just a generous man, he's a gracious man. And the world needs to know by his conduct and by his character that when mercy is extended through his hand, it comes from a man who is doing so on behalf of the church, doing so for Christ's sake. His life is to bear testimony to that. If he's living a scandalous life, whatever mercy will be received will not be seen as an act of the church, not reflect upon the goodness of Christ. And so the man must abstain from these things. You find here, in verse 9, just this point, we're called here to see that the deacons are also to hold the mystery of the faith in a pure conscience. What's striking is that's precisely what Timothy was urged to do in chapter 1. He, as perhaps an evangelist, perhaps a pastor, he was called to do the self-same thing. And so the calling of the diaconate is not divorced from the gospel. It requires the man to know it, because from that knowledge and from that experience, he will most represent Christ in his work. The diaconate is also something that must be proven. As the deacon approaches the office, he must demonstrate that he has these qualities. He must prove that he is so gifted, and in the proving of it, found blameless. That's actually a different word than we had previously to describe the gospel minister. In other words, the man is to go through the trial. The trial, perhaps not a formal thing, but the man is to exemplify already these kinds of gifts, both the holding of the faith with a good conscience and the aptness to know when mercy is needed in its distribution. We also find here, friend, that just as it was with the minister of the gospel, the man is to demonstrate that he is faithful in all things. Faithful as a leader in the home, you'll notice this. And so the discussion about his wives and his children. They are to rule their own houses well. If they cannot manage their houses, if we'll drop down just the paragraph that was before, if they cannot manage their own households well, how can they manage the funds of the church that are to be distributed for the good of those both within and without? It's the sense. These are men who are to be tinged with the gospel. Men whose lives, as it were, are filled with the aroma of Christ's likeness. Now, as we conclude here, just a word of application first to gospel ministers. Friend, this is your list of qualifications. No, these are not all that the scriptures hold out as your calling. There are other qualifications to be met, but these ones are certainly qualifications. They're absolutely necessary to your calling. It's tempting to think that sometimes your people will need a polished sermon. That they'll need a great orator. What they need is a godly man. They may think from time to time that they need those other things. The apostle says they need a godly man. And so study these things. Make these things frequent mention in your prayer. And also, friend, heed the warning. The warnings are severe. In verse 6 and verse 7, the condemnation of the devil stands over those who pursue this office with pride. The reproach and snare of the devil follow those whose lives do not testify to the grace of God. Why is it that there's this mention of the devil then? I think Calvin following Chrysostom is very helpful here. You see, the calling is a high calling, as we've already seen. It's a good calling. And the reality is that as good as the calling is, the fall from it is all the greater. Just as Satan falling was a great, great fall, so too the one who pursues the ministry with these infirmities induces a great fall. As I said before, there are applications not just to the minister. There are applications, of course, to all of those who are presbyters, to ruling elders as well. All that is said here of the ministers that separates it from that is that they are to be apt to teach. But every other qualification is necessary. Every other qualification is required for those who hold the office. You see, the reality is the church is to exemplify in both the minister of the gospel and in the ruling elder all of these things, the power of the gospel. And so, friend, we are exhibited to those who are called are called to exhibit all of these things, whether in the pastorate, in which the aptness to teach is particular, or to the ruling elder, in which all of the others are also equally obliging. It is absolutely necessary. The church requires, needs men who are these kinds of men. But friend, to the deacon as well, there's so much that the apostle says. To the deacon, friend, appreciate the holiness of this calling. That's perhaps something that we forget, but here the apostle would tell us very plainly. It is a holy calling instituted by Christ for Christ's sake and the good of the church. And we already saw the benefits of that. The benefits of a faithful deacon to a congregation is nothing less than the boldness of the proclamation of the gospel and the great revival that you find in the church of Jerusalem. And so this is a holy calling. This is not a hobby. This is one's, perhaps the highest calling in a man's life to this office. And so, friend, pray. Pray for these qualifications just as the minister of the gospel and the elders to pray for them. These things are necessary to the office, absolutely incumbent upon the man who holds it. And then, friend, pray for faithfulness in it as well. It's one thing to have these for a time, but pray that these things will become more and more fruitful and fructifying in the church. But I'll close then now with the congregation in view. As I said previously, this is a text that I think we tend to isolate. Well, if I'm not a deacon, if I'm not a pastor, then these things don't pertain to me. But I would remind you of Paul's exhortation to the church at Ephesus. Well, really, his exhortation to Timothy, but by extension to the church. The minister is to be an example in these things. That means an example to follow. You see, yes, those who are called to these offices are called urgently to be these things. But the obligation to be these things falls upon every man. Every man. And insofar as it pertains to women as well, it's obliging for godliness, thorough godliness, to be evident in the church. The ministers are only examples leading the way. The officers of the church only, as it were, a pattern that will be filled and followed by those who are in the congregation. And so that leaves, friend, the congregation with the obligation to pray. Friend, make this your prayer. As you pray for elders, as you pray for ministers, as you pray for deacons, don't stray far from this list. Because these are the men who have been called to lead you into Christ's likeness by Christ. Oh, it's so tempting to have our own list of things that we need and that we want. But friend, this, says Christ, is what is absolutely necessary for the church. For godly men to be her officers. And that so that the people of God might be led into Christ's likeness all the more. Pray earnestly for that. But it's really a two-edged sword, isn't it, friend? When this ministry is present, when these officers are in the congregation, it's one thing if men and women make use of them and do follow them in their example. But it's quite another thing when men and women enjoy these ministers but don't follow. You remember the words of Samuel. As Samuel looks at the congregation of Israel after he's ministered for so many decades, he asks the question, "Have I defrauded any man?" The answer was resoundingly no. "I've declared to you everything that God has spoken. I've not changed a word." The congregation responds yes. Then Samuel says, "And then it's a testimony against you if you do not follow." Paul, when he addresses the church, the elders of the church at Ephesus, in Acts 20, he leaves very much the same idea. Friend, the kind of ministry that you have in 1 Timothy 3 is either for your good or it's a testimony against you. And woe to the man, to the woman who is unconverted under such ministers. It's one thing on the last day for your conscience to cry out that you are guilty, that every sermon that you've heard, every act of mercy that you've received has done your soul no good. Oh, but it's quite another thing when your minister himself comes and in pleading with Christ says, "You know that I have been faithful. All my failings are there. But this one heard the gospel. This one knew the truth. Their blood is on their heads and not my hands. I have done the work of a watchman." Friend, don't let that be said of you. And so, as you pray for these things, pray that God would also grant the grace to make use of these things aright. Because that really is the calling that's incumbent upon all of us this evening. Amen.